Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, May 3rd, is Sunday, a quasi-holiday that celebrates the virtues of solar energy and apparently attracts thousands of sun power lovers to events all across the USA. Tuesday was the annual delirium of May Day, which is the first subject of today's mosaical program, and an updated version of my intermittently annual pagan tribute to the vernal glories and horrors of spring. May Day 2018, and as I more or less previously said, it's a rewrite of the previous, as it is every year. And I wrote it, so the responsibility is all mine. May Day, a call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect for all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable and short-sighted, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty and economic inequality. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. The future blows a sour breath at the unsettled present. Earthquakes, fires, floods, and human bedlam ravage the planet. Peace is not on earth, but a few feet underneath for millions who die from war, hunger, disease, or abuse. Refugees from horror and strife abound. Many are denied refuge. The old especially suffer. They are too often abandoned to starve or freeze. Children are malnourished and preyed upon. Their frightened, hungry, pleading faces stare at us from everywhere. As diverse populations of the world move increasingly toward a global civilization, elements in every society resist and clamor for separation and for racial and cultural purification. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. Hatred and intolerance are once more legitimized into rule. World leaders move piteously against their own peoples and neighbors. Armies and police murder innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are the major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of world annihilation once more looms from nuclear blackmail and criminal irresponsibility. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. We will most likely strangle on the effluence of our uneven affluence. This already chaotic and frenzied adolescent millennium is an X-ray of our history, which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon, but history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. Millennialism evokes old prophecies. Apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand flourish and seize theological power all over the world. Inexorable bipolar dogmata, armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. And depravity has fallen upon the United States. Since the absurdly improbable election of Donald Trump as the country's 45th president, the ancient and atrocious issue of white supremacy, the persecution of other races and of religions not puritanically Christian, is once more a major theme in American politics. The complex fabric of democracy, tolerance, and human rights in the United States is threatened with collapse, resulting from rampant corruption, deceit, and malice. The nation has been caught up in a whirlwind of prearranged prejudices from which there seems no end of injustices perpetrated by the White House. Every day is unnervedly hyperventilating, either startling or horrifying, often both with an added broth of shock and awful. Trump's virtual war on truth and veracity, his disfiguring of democratic society into a gulag state of imprisoned immigrants and refugees awaiting deportation, while alienating nearly every other nation with his self-obsessed America First isolationist jingoism, have unnecessarily made the world a much more dangerous place for everybody. Trump sternly boasts of the need of the U.S. to demonstrate so-called hard power in foreign relations, which seems to be an impulsive schoolyard bully's masturbatory fantasy with grotesquely possible results. From the moment of his election, the most vocal and consistent concern has been his proximity to the nuclear trigger. The doomsday clock of the Association of Atomic Scientists was moved back to 2.5 minutes to midnight for the first time since the Cold War on Trump's inauguration day. This January, it was moved another 30 seconds to 2 minutes before midnight. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet, optimism persists, perhaps because in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that was something I wrote, May Day, which is revised this time and every time from the first time, Uno de Mayo, 1983, in the North Coast Times Eagle. And now, two by Dr. Robert Brake. The first, More or Less, Our American Conundrum, by Dr. Brake. Throughout my adult life, I have struggled to find the meaning of big Socratic ideas like truth, justice, virtue, and happiness. But lately, I have focused on two narrower notions, enough and more. I have had enough of the rich and their tax cut infatuation, and I am convinced that the 1% has hoodwinked Americans into believing they create jobs, have special entrepreneurial talents, and never hide their massive wealth. I have had enough of Trump's tweets, whether he is being strategic or just bumbling into stomach-churning racist rants, attacking the media, or diverting attention from his possible obstruction of justice or money laundering. I have had enough of warmongering, our unwillingness to face up to racism, and our ongoing sexual harassment scandals. And more incidentally, I have had enough of those ridiculous new consumer products like voice-activated toilets, mind-reading cars, robot-propelled luggage, and smart underwear. Need I mention untucked shirts? So now I am wondering why we put up with all that. Are we embracing really nebulous notions of what enough should be? Or are we really obsessed with more? America is not so much a place as a desire for more. We Americans harbor a fundamental belief that we are entitled to more, should be spending more, working for more, consuming more, and amassing more. Our lives seem governed by a sinking feeling that we should all amount to more, that we would be more successful if we only had more Nikes, more cars, more vacation homes, more fame, and more money. And we export that desire for more through our seductive advertising and the glamorous picture-perfect world of our movies. We make people all over the world hunger for the idea of America, a money-making machine, hungry for products that make us smile with our bright white teeth. But few of us Americans seem really happy. We are too busy making more. So we constantly compare ourselves to the rich and famous, who flaunt their more, creating a deeper hunger and craving. Of course, the rich and famous are often the most miserable of all, since hoarding so dominates their lives that they can't quite settle on the meaning of the word enough. But perhaps we can resolve to do something about our obsession with more. Maybe it's the time to redefine enough. I think enough is a place located in each of us. And if each of us develops a clearer idea of what enough is, we will see that there is time for gazing into eyes and gardens and staring off at the ocean and the stars. We will have time for long extended touches and good espresso and aimless conversations and chocolate cake a la mode and just doing nothing. What does your enough look like? How would it feel? By defining enough, you might define or redefine what you are really after. Then Thomas Jefferson's memorable phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, might take on a newer, more special meaning for each of us. Our focus might shift from making to being. We might actually see one another more clearly and care more about what's going on around us. We might collectively put our new focus on things in America that really matter: education, childcare, health care for all, the arts, science, prevention of violence, prison reform, caring for the homeless, and reducing hunger and poverty, rather than focusing so much of our attention on our individual need for more. To enjoy fully satisfying moments, we might think less about making more and more about what is enough. That kind of fullness might translate into love. Yet for me, a cleared notion of enough might be too much. Here is my to-do list that might make America better. America would be better if cancer had a cure, race were never an issue, diversity was appreciated, everyone respected facts, traffic jams and airport delays were inconceivable. We didn't need jails. Rude people could be ticketed and fined. Big band songs made the top 40. Everyone loved to learn for the sake of learning. Apathy was unheard of. We could not only teach our old dogs new tricks, but make them computer literate. Children didn't have to worry. All parents were good ones. Grandparents spent more time with the grandkids. Children looked up to Mother Teresa as much as they do Britney Spears or Taylor Swift. And America's leaders regarded global warming as potentially cataclysmic and did something about it. Is that enough? Or should I be asking for more? And the second of Dr. Brake's articles that I'm reading today, Truth or Consequences. President Donald Trump is more a consequence than a cause of our current concern about the disregard of what should pass for truth. And that's in quotes, truth. We are experiencing a battle between two ways of perceiving our complex world, two fundamentally different approaches to reality from which we must choose. And we can't sit out that decision or sit on the fence. Looking back on Trump's 2016 win over Hillary Clinton, I am convinced that the American electorate was in no mood to hear about Clinton's qualifications or, conversely, to pay much attention to those warnings of Trump's lies, bigotry, and amateurism. Trump was never regarded as a sympathetic candidate. Indeed, the opinion polls showed that the American people were well aware of his character flaws. Yet he communicated a brutal empathy to them, not rooted in facts or statistics or meticulously acquired information, but an uninhibited talent for rage, impatience, and the easy attribution of blame. Trump loomed as a candidate, not interested in speaking the truth, but one who was a different sort, who just might address voters' anxieties and hopes. The real defining characteristic of what political columnist Matthew Ancolcno calls post-truth is that we prefer to choose our own reality as if from a buffet. Forget about determining the truth by rational evaluation, assessment, and conclusion. As Rob Brotherton cogently notes in his 2016 paperback, Suspicious Minds, Why We Believe Conspiracy Theories, we build a fortress of positive information around our beliefs and we rarely step outside or even peek out the window. It is important to note that according to recent, perhaps arguable research, it is often those who are most knowledgeable about politics and science who tend to take extreme positions on, for instance, climate change and death panels. So higher education offers no insulation against magical thinking. As Brotherton puts it, our beliefs come first. We make up reasons for them as we go along. Being smarter or having access to more information doesn't necessarily make us less susceptible to faulty beliefs. And that was Brotherton again. In the film Apocalypse Now, Marlon Brando as Colonel Kurtz asks Martin Sheen's Willard to tell his son all he has seen at his Cambodian compound. Everything I did, everything you saw, because there's nothing that I detest more than the stench of lies. And if you understand me, Willard, you will do this for me. As dubious a model as Colonel Kurtz surely is, he reminds all of us that lies contaminate all they touch. The greatest peril of our post-truth era may be that our sense of smell has failed us. We have become indifferent or inured to the stench of lies, reigning into the malodorous atmosphere of competing truth claims. The flames of democratic collapse have yet to consume our society, but our collective smoke alarm seems faulty. How to deal with the war on truth? Satire and ridicule might help, especially when aimed at political buffoons, conspiracy zealots, or others whose clandestine technologies exploit social media, polarizing and entrenching opinion. So where trust is evaporating, we need to restore it with facts, science, and determination to enlighten the frightened. We can fight back, as the articulate, courageous students in Parkland, Florida, have so well demonstrated. We do perceive truth in so many different ways. That famous tagline from the TV series The X-Files, "The truth is out there," merely proposed that truth is out there for us to discover. When Colonel Jessup, the Jack Nicholson character from the film A Few Good Men, barked, "You can't handle the truth," he was a cornered coward, shielding himself from the real truth. And Stephen Colbert's meme, Truthiness, rightly zeroed in on our penchant for going to the gut and bypassing the brain as we search for meaning. What we feel to be true doesn't make something true. So let's hunker down and fight back. Despite all the talk of public apathy and disengagement, I remain an optimist. In spite of all the psychological tricks we play on ourselves, I think that we are ultimately hardwired to demand veracity and to resist falsehood. There is a voice within each of us that resists lies, even if that voice is sometimes muted. The challenge is to turn that voice from a whisper to a roar. The truth is out there, if only we demand it. And that was by Robert Brake, Truth or Consequences, and the previous one that I read by him, More or Less, Our American Conundrum. Dr. Brake is a retired teacher and freelance writer who lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He is frequently featured on this program and writes for the Chinook Observer. I would like now to read a letter written to the Daily Astorian by Rita Smith, whom I have gladly known for 30 years and who called me on the phone a few days ago. She is a fierce advocate for animals in distress and founder and director of River Song Foundation, which is an archery for her concern for wretchedly abandoned, abused, and homeless former pets. Another impassioned concern for her is the insane escalation of gun violence in the United States and the sorry fact that gun rights trump human rights and safety. This is what she wrote about. Guns Are Us, by Rita Smith. Living in Hammond, I have become accustomed to the sound of gunfire. I have learned to distinguish between the training exercises at Camp Rialia, cannon fire, or war reenactments at the military museum, and recently the disturbing sounds of what must be the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers shooting cormorants. The frequent sounds of gunshots in the night make me shudder. I wonder about the dozens of spent shotgun shells I find daily on the river beaches where I walk my dog. As I heard of the 45th shooting of the year, I think of the connection between our culture's acceptance of violence, in particular gun violence, and the escalating violence in our society. We routinely use violence to solve our issues, whether fighting wars, killing animals or birds we perceive to interfere with our lives, or ever increasingly to express our frustration and anger. We play war in our off times and glorify it in our celebrations and memorials. The shop-worn adage, guns don't kill people, people kill people, is fraught with false logic. While people who use guns to kill people usually have either temporary or long-term emotional issues, the crimes they commit could not happen, at least as easily or frequently, without guns. The discharging of a gun is instant and irrevocable. Even those who plan their rampages would have a hard time carrying them out without a gun as their choice of weapon. I do not believe our founders meant for us to use their thoughtfully and carefully worded Second Amendment to defend the widespread manufacture and use of guns to perpetuate the overwhelming violence that exists in our country today. Ironically, the word gun is not even present in the amendment. Indeed, the Supreme Court has ruled that the scope of an individual's right to bear arms is not unlimited and thus open to regulation. No one wishes to prevent anyone from having the means to protect themselves in dangerous situations, but it is time to de-escalate the violence around us and help prevent future tragedies. We must reevaluate words written long ago in a very different time and understand that if we do not, we will become the tyrants our forefathers meant to protect us from. And that was Guns Are Us by Rita Smith. And now, the Oregon primary for the midterm elections is May 15th. Mail-in ballots will soon be drone-flighted to all our addresses, but not this election. I will read Perpetual Politics by Bunny Dore with a quote from Geraldine Ferraro, "All issues are women's issues." Thinking about politics, the North Coast Women's Political Caucus, of which I am a longtime member, thinks about politics all the time. Who is going to be the next county commissioner? Are there any openings on the boards and commissions of Clatsop County or the cities of Astoria, Seaside, Warrenton, Napa, Cannon Beach? The purpose of the local caucus, as of caucuses throughout the United States, is to involve women in politics from the local school board to the White House. The caucus does not care whether they are Republicans, Democrats, or Independents, or if they are Libertarians, followers of Ross Perot, or members of a Green Party. They are not concerned with age, nationality, race, ethnic background, or marital status, except to try to reach every segment of the population. As long as they are feminist women, the caucus wants to recruit them, train them, support, and elect them. Feminist women, yes, meaning those who believe in equality for women, economic, social, political, and in women's right to be heard. As a member of the State Steering Committee of the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, I can point out some touchstones for women, and some men, supported by the group. They must be pro-choice, without reservations. They must believe in the worth of an equal rights amendment, and they must support measures to provide child care, even if it means government subsidies are required. In the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, women must get into the political game and stay in it. And that was Perpetual Politics by Bunny Dorr. She wrote this for the North Coast Times Eagle in the summer of 1997. She died in 1998 after a long life of newspapering and political organizing. And I have read this Perpetual Politics that she wrote several times and probably will many times more on the air, if, of course, I am still on the air. I finished today's program with a shout out to Michelle Wolf for her hilarious contempt for bullies and liars of any gender. Wolf said in response to criticism of her scathing portrait of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her smoky eye at the annual correspondence dinner last weekend that she was not talking about Sanders' facial makeup, but her, quote, despicable behavior, unquote, as Donald Trump's mouthpiece. So in support of Wolf's right to pillory power, I repeat my own previous impudent lampoon of Sanders on this program 6 months ago. I call it the picture of Dorian Trump. Has anyone lately reread Oscar Wilde's famously infamous novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, or rewatched the 1945 movie of the same name with the magnificently grotesque portrait by the wondrous, strange American artist Ivan Albright? In the possibility some of you might not remember the essentials, it was notoriously noted in the late Victorian era of its publication to have been called a homoerotic novel. But this is not about that. The original story was pegged on a just-finished painting of a glorious young man whose evil deeds to both women and men, as subsequent years wore on, never flawed his eternally youthful appearance, but instead the portrait reflected his incessant, unabated grotesquerie. So now imagine an immediately contemporary distortion of Wilde's story, that rather of painting the real-life face of Sarah Huckabee Sanders as she almost daily commits perjury to members of the American media and virtually shamelessly parrots the lines, the lies, and falsehoods of Donald Trump. The basic dissimilarity is that Sarah Huckabee Sanders' face is the canvas that minutely transmogrifies into a subtle degradation of her facial features with every falsehood straight off Trump's forked tongue. She acts as his doppelduper, a duplicitous caricature of his diseased deceit and monstrous megalomania. Trump's lies flow out from him like contaminated water. He is unable and unwilling to distinguish fact from fake, and perversely denounces anyone who refutes his trumped-up fabrications as liars and fakes. He remains unrepentant by the chaos and evil he recklessly provokes because he absolutely has no sense of a moral compass other than his own loathsome personal pathologies. Sarah Huckabee Sanders seems unaware of her deforming surrogacy, yet each twice-told tale ripples across her face as a disfiguring metastasis. All that bad karma settles in her lying eyes and deforms her deceitful mouth. She is literally the public face of Donald Trump. And this is Michael McCusker. Saturday is Cinco de Mayo, otherwise known as Mexico's Independence Day, which provides a fine opportunity for a few relevant quotes from Benito Juarez, one of his most famous being, "Among individuals, as among nations, respect for the rights of others is peace." He also said, "The law has always been my shield and my sword." And that was Benito Juarez. And do you hear that, Donald Trump? Cinco de Mayo is also the birthdays of Loyola Merriman and Karl Marx. Happy Cinco de Mayo.